Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Good morning, Mark. I'd like to ask you how you're feeling, but I have a general sense from our pre-recording chat, but maybe I'll let you introduce how you're feeling today to the rest of the group. But nice to see you again.
Yeah, it's nice to be seen. You know, it's really nice to have my little granddaughter clock gonging in the background. I hope that doesn't disturb any of our listeners. But yeah, it's winter in Minnesota. There's, I don't know, an inch or so of snow on the ground. And I've got stupid little moose ice skating coffee cup, you know, with a latte.
Yeah. I have my little snow person, but it is a Tim Hortons cup, for those who know. So, and for those who don't, it is a red Tim Hortons cup. Yeah.
That's right. The colors are so bright.
I heard
it. I'm right in the middle of experiencing a little bit of the medicine that we often prescribe.
Oh, my goodness.
9 days out from a knee replacement, enjoying every moment of it, as you can imagine. It's the easiest thing ever.
Well, they say it's a wonderful procedure when you look back at it. But when you're in it, I'm sure it's different. I'm sure it's very different.
Yeah, no, it's good. But I've been home, not shaving, as you can see. It's, you know,
I noticed that. Yes.
Yeah.
You've got a very distinguished look.
Back when I was, I don't know, 15 or 16, I tried to grow a mustache. And my father said, oh, that's a football mustache. And I said, what do you mean? He said, 11 on a side.
I like that. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Well, today, Mark, we're going to try to distract you, even if we can for a few minutes, with this idea of creativity. Get your creative juices, I guess, percolating, so to speak, pardon the pun. But we have Alex Tabane. Alex Tabane is near completion of his PhD at McMaster University, and he's taken on an interesting topic, which is creativity in surgery. But as you'll find, I think he's thinking creatively much more broadly. Alex, welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast. And thanks again for spending a bit of time with us and chatting with us about, you know, why we need creativity in surgery. And so let me just begin. Before we get into a definition, why do we need creativity in surgery? And what's been your assessment of it?
Yeah, well, firstly, thank you, gentlemen, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be a part of the podcast. Why do we need creativity in surgery? Well, I think my goal in this whole PhD work is to kind of is not to convince surgeons, but to show them what they already know, and which is that creativity is something that permeates every aspect of the profession. If you think about it from the aesthetic standpoint, as far as, you know, trying to create things that are beautiful and, you know, having outcomes that are pleasing to the patient. But I think when it comes to problem solving, when it comes to innovations, I think surgery is a profession that has benefited a lot from innovations. If you think about the history of surgery, even going back 20, 30 years ago, the advancement of the profession has been benefited by creative surgeons, creative individuals who have kind of challenged existing ways of doing things, coming up with new ways that are more effective and different that lead to better outcomes. And I think the goal of this work is to kind of show people that, you know, creativity is something that we should value. It's a critical skill to the modern day surgeon. And if the profession is going to advance and challenge these kind of, be able to kind of conquer these new challenges that are coming across in the modern day operating room, I think creativity is going to be a valuable skill for the profession at large.
So the one thing, and the challenge that comes up, and I know that when you talk about, well, in surgery, and you've done some research on this that talks specifically about, you know, testing in some ways through validated measures, you know, the creative potential of our trainees. But before we get to that information, one might argue, a contrarian might argue, the place where I don't want people to be creative is I don't want my surgeon to be creative in the operating room. I don't want my pilot to be creative, and I don't want those of us who are in the military, for example, leading, you know, a major initiative to be creative. There's process, right? The same reason there's a checklist in for pilots, it's because it's almost like in those situations we have to follow, you know, an order. How do you defend that against this thing that, well, maybe surgeons and maybe training is going to be, by definition, making surgeons much more focused on process than on, let's say, being ultra creative.
Yeah. How I would answer that is I totally agree. I think for the most part, the standardization of things in surgery is it leads to, you know, less variability in outcomes. It leads to higher safety. And I think, like you mentioned, things like aviation, things like military, things like the profession of surgery, standardization is for good reason. And so I'm not kind of advocating for just a helter-skelter use of, you know, let's just come up with new ideas and try things. And like, this is what surgery should be. It should just be this kind of haphazard use of creative ideas. That's not what we're saying. I think what we're saying is that you have this kind of spectrum of creative problems that occur in the operating room. And I think most of them are predictable, and most of them are what we call well-defined problems in psychology, where, you know, they can be solved algorithmically. And that makes up probably 90 to 95% of the things you see in the operating room. And I think that is evidenced by the fact that, you know, the effectiveness of the importance of preoperative planning. If you look at the training process, which is an apprenticeship training process, if you look at the standardization of things in the profession, I think the effectiveness of these things is evidence of how predictable and how, you know, standardizable some of these things are. But I think that 5% where you encounter a problem in the operating room and you say, wow, okay, so the thing that I've been trained to do is not working. How do I solve this? I think that is where the ability to be creative comes into play. And that's like what we call the everyday creativity aspect of creativity in surgery. You know, just being able to solve those problems when you encounter them and you don't have that standardized solution available, I think that is where creativity really comes in to play for surgery. And then also the wider thing of just challenging the existing processes and existing approaches. If we even look at arthroplasty, you know, there's a range of approaches that are available to the surgeon. A lot of it is based off, you know, surgeon preference and things like that. But somebody had to come up with these approaches. Somebody had to challenge the way that, you know, see the limitations of the things, ways were being done, come up with new devices to be able to make things, you know, new things possible. So I think there's two trains of thought here where you think about its utility in the everyday sense, and there's the utility and, you know, what we call this eminent creativity, which is, you know, things that are going to actually change the domain.
Great.
Yeah, Alex, I want to jump on the concept of 5% when something doesn't go as planned. And every surgeon has been there when the device isn't going in well, or you can't get the fracture reduced or whatever. And what would you say, I know you put a lot of work into this, what do you say are the building blocks of successful creativity? Is it knowledge of anatomy? Is it how to calm your anxiety? Is it quick to seek consultation? What are kind of the elements of successful creativity when something is going poorly?
Yeah, and I think this is what I'm hoping will be my life's work, and really breaking this down into seeing what these actual components are. And I think if you think about it, we just developed a definition. I'll just cite it quickly, which we talk about, you know, the interaction between expertise, motivation, environment, and processes. And I think you kind of alluded to some of those things right now. Like there are certain environmental aspects that kind of are conducive to creativity. Like surgery is, you know, it's a team event. And so there's going to be an environment that is conducive to being able to solve problems. You're not solving those problems alone. So I think there's, you know, these team aspects and team dynamics, communication, things like that. If we think about expertise, you kind of mentioned surgical experience is critical. And that's something we saw in our focus group data, is that, you know, surgical experience helps you see what doesn't work and know what doesn't work in the past, so that you can kind of, you know, generate ideas and evaluate your ideas for moving forward in a way that takes into account the, you know, your pre-existing experience. I think surgical experience is critical for that. And if you think about, we call that like the domain specific expertise that is required, you know, surgical experience, technical expertise, things like that. But then there's also general kind of characteristics that have been found in literature to be, you know, leading to more creative ideas. If you think about intelligence, just your ability to come up with a lot of ideas, to be able to connect distant ideas when you're working memory space. And that's a very common one. We talk about motivation. Intrinsic motivation is a big one. You know, you have to, especially when we're talking about eminent creativity, coming up with new techniques, you have to have that internal desire to be able to solve a problem. And, you know, a lot of that comes from, you know, having that internal intrinsic motivation that can kind of fuel you and keep you, you know, fuel that fire so that you have that ability to come kind of generate those new ideas, evaluate them, and kind of, so there's a lot of different aspects. There's also personality aspects to it. Openness to experience is a big one, extroversion. So it's a multifactorial thing. And I think the real interesting question that we're kind of coming across now is, like, we know generally some of these personal and team characteristics, but in the field of surgery, what are the exact things that you need to, what are the exact characters? What's the creative profile of the, you know, the creative surgeon? Like, what is it about surgery in specific and the surgeon in specific that makes people, you know, what are the exact technical expertises and expertises that are domain general that makes them able to, you know, be creative? I think that is the big question. And if I can pose the question to you, you know, when you see maybe a resident who's been into your, in your training or even yourself, like, what do you notice about people that makes them, or you think, why is this person creative? You know, like, why are they, like, is there something that you notice about them that's, you know, a common thread amongst people who you find are able to generate ideas creatively?
Yeah, I would say top of the list is curiosity. Just, you know, wondering why that's the right answer, wondering why that's the approach you always use, wondering why, how come that implant is better. I think what I've learned through 40 years of working with trainees is being curious about why, and that usually leads to different approaches.
And I think I would just add to that point, which is individuals who I know take time away to, and I'll use the word think broadly, but they take time away from the problem they're trying to solve. And so one of the opening questions I'll ask Alex often is, so, you know, let's say you're not at work, how do you keep yourself busy? What kind of things do you like to do? And then that opens up this, for me, a sense of how they re-energize, recharge, and ultimately how they think. And that gives you insight to that. I'm curious, because I know you've done, I think it was like 78 or 80 trainees across various levels of training, and you evaluated creativity. Did any of these things come up in your analysis of what happens with trainees? And more importantly, Mark, let me ask this, because I obviously I was involved in this publication, but what do you think happens if you were to do a test of creativity, however we look at that, in this particular case, let's say divergent thinking, the ability to come up with lots of ideas, original ideas, ideas that link to other things. What would you think, how do you think a PGY1 versus a PGY5 would perform on those tests if you were hypothesizing?
Oh, I would think the PGY1 would fare better because they're not indoctrinated with the right answer for everything. What I've always said for the last 30 plus years is, nobody smarter than a fourth year resident. They have an answer for everything and they're super confident of it. And then it gets, you get less sure of it as the years go on from there on.
Great. I don't know, Alex, did you want to unveil the results briefly?
Well, I think Dr. Swankowski just revealed them for us. So we did a creativity test. This was part of my master's thesis. We did what it's called a divergent thinking test. This is a very classical measure of creativity. We gave it to around, you know, 80 or so residents. Along, you know, people who had not even started their surgical training were in their core principles training in the summer, you know, before they'd even really gotten into the profession. And then we also gave it to people who were 5+ years beyond. And we found exactly that. We found that they actually scored higher in, you know, those early years, you know, the first 0 to 2 years, they had the highest creativity scores, actually higher than the average normative adult. And then as they went throughout the residency, the scores just kept coming down and down. And we, you know, it was a very interesting finding. And I think the most important thing, or at least one of the most interesting things that I found, is that this was primarily driven by a drop in what we call originality, or, you know, the novelty, or, you know, the novelty of the ideas. The ideas just became so standardized. I think what we saw is that, you know, surgeons are able to come up with a lot of ideas, you know, and I think this is linked to things like intelligence, you know, just the ability to kind of generate ideas. We saw that they had a strong ability to do that throughout residency. But as they went through residency, the ideas and the originality of their ideas just continued to go down. And I think that is, you know, evidence of the fact that you talked about indoctrination. I think that's a big one. You know, you get used to doing certain things in a certain way and not questioning it. And I think what you said is like that first principles thinking, like, why is this the best way to do it? Is it the best way to do that? I think that there's probably something to that, that kind of these residents are losing as they go through training. And I think we interviewed some of the highest scoring people and they said the exact same thing. Where, you know, they felt like, you know, residency is a little bit of this box. And if I want to do well in medicine, you know, I have to find a kind of play the game. And I had to kind of put my creativity to the side. Some of these creative people were, you know, professional level cellist players. I think, you know, medicine is, it's blessed with like a wealth of talented people. If you think about the people who try to get into medical school, it's the 95th percentile of individuals in university alone. So you're looking at people who have a wealth of, you know, knowledge, experience, dimensionality in their lives. You have the pick of the crop, and it's just a shame that, you know, or at least there's some evidence showing that, you know, residency and medical training it's so demanding, it's so rigid that these people who have so much to offer are kind of having this squeezed out of them a little bit.
Let me ask you this, Alex. You know, when you think about, and I'll say practical uses, so there's the individual use, you know, being more creative in theory should help make a program stronger, should make the individual better, should improve their life, all these sorts of things that are often, you know, I mean, they're often hard to measure. There's often surrogates for how you'd measure, you know, the impact of creativity on a program or on an individual. But like, for example, you know, I've heard it time and time again, and we've all been part of groups. Mark, you must have been part of many advisory groups in which you sometimes sit there and say, I wonder how this group was assembled, right? And often it's just haphazardly assembled, or it's through various leadership roles that people get put part of a group. Do you think the same way we think about ensuring that a group is inclusive and it's diverse, could we create a creativity quotient? Could there be something that says, you know, if we want a group to actually come up with good ideas, are there certain types of people that function better to help develop those ideas? And are we measuring that when we're bringing groups together to hopefully, quote, solve the problems that are critical in whatever institution or environment we're in?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think that's something that a lot of people are not privy to, and they put together these teams. You kind of select people based off of CV or based off of reputation. And, you know, that can act as like a generally good surrogate measure for, you know, competency and contribution potential. But I think what you said there is like basically, you know, taking what we talked about creative individuals and these characteristics of creative individuals and doing a similar thing at the team level. Like, what is the characteristics of a team that is creative? Are they diverse? In what ways are they diverse? Is there different age characteristics? Are there different gender characteristics? What about a creative team makes them able to be creative? And I think that is another question that, you know, we're doing a study on that now, looking at the literature to find out, because I think very few times in life are you really working on things individually. I think a lot of the time, you know, you're working in a team, you're working in a team at work, you're working in a team in the operating room, and creating an environment or creating a way in which people learn to interact with each other in a way that is conducive to at least the, you know, the consideration of ideas. Maybe you don't have to implement them, but I think there's ways that you can kind of create teams that are more conducive to, you know, creative thoughts, creative ideas, and finding a way to, you know, do that in an ethical way and evaluating them to find out which ones are going to be the best ones. I think that is really the way forward. You can see that, you know, you can apply that to the operating room. You can apply that to the C-suite. You can apply that to advisory boards. There's an infinite amount of places in which you can apply creative teams, because we all work in teams everywhere.
Yeah, Mo, I'd like to just jump in here and kind of make a bridge to the scholarly publication world that we live in now. It's a real challenge when people are submitting original research work that doesn't fit the mold, and to find reviewers that are willing to consider that this might be a legitimate way to approach things can be very, very difficult. I know you're seeing that now, sitting in the chair, sitting in the captain's chair, and it's a real struggle, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it gets back to the idea of impact, right? So, you know, productivity is like, you can get lots of papers published. We've seen that in the publication world. But sometimes the stuff that has impact is stuff that is so different from everything else that's been done. And to your exact point, Alex, when you have, I won't use the word indoctrinated, but a belief system that, you know, we already know how this problem works, and you have a group of a community that says, this is how we solve this problem, and you have a what seems like an out there idea, that often is very, very hard. I'll put it very simple. Alex, how hard has it been for you in the idea of creativity research in surgery to get funding over, let's say, colleagues I know of yours who are doing implant A versus implant B trials?
Yeah, like I'm firsthand experiencing the skepticism and pushback on this. So yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's a function of the system, right? Like, people use these surrogate measures of publication number, and there's a very, you could turn, you know, I'm sure you guys know, as, you know, editors of a large journal, it's very easy to turn publishing into a game where you can just pump papers out and use the given template, and that's fine. But, you know, a measure fails to be a good measure when it becomes the target. And I think the publication system, and probably the grant system as well, I'm not so as familiar with the grant system, I think it becomes that, because once you figure out, oh, I don't really have to think about what's going to be the most impactful thing to do here? I can just do things that I know will do well in the committee who's going to be, you know, reviewing my work, and I'll get funded, I'll get published. And those are the things that get rewarded in my academic life. You know, impact takes a side, it takes a backseat to what gives you the, you know, the outcomes that you want, which is academic success, right?
Your point's well taken. And I think, is, you know, when you look at two extremes, like let's say the Nobel laureate world and academics, for example, it's not an unusual story, right, to hear of a Nobel laureate who said, yeah, I was on a fringe and, you know, I was having a difficult time getting individuals engaged. And then they went to individuals outside of their discipline, actually, and got buy-in outside of their discipline. And I think, and I guess maybe a question I have for you as we kind of, you know, I'll take the prerogative here, Mark, if you don't have any other follow-ups, to maybe ask Alex a final question, which is across all of this work, and albeit you're very early in this, right? So I'm sure we'll look back 5 years from now and think differently about all the work that's been done and how much more your efforts have led to just a dialogue around what it means to be creative. But right now, what advice would you give an early career resident, someone who is early career in their work, or someone even, you know, who sort of thinks that they already know it, right? Like I've been doing this for 20 years. I don't need to bring more creativity into my life. What are the daily habits that you've picked up from your research that you are applying daily that you'd like to share with others to say, you know, try this?
Yeah. I think if I had to distill into three things, I would say it would be curiosity. I know Dr. Swankowski said that. I think curiosity is, you know, the fuel for, you know, asking deeper questions. I think playfulness, retaining that element of playfulness and realizing that, you know, your ways of thinking when you were younger and you kind of have these big ideas. Yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of them are, you know, fanciful and things like that. But I think having that element of playfulness, having, you know, and taking time to, you know, think big, think differently. I think we all are brought into this world with this ability. And I think we lose that over time as we become adults. And, you know, fighting to retain that, I think is important. And I think first principles thinking is important. Thinking about, you know, why do things work the way they work? Breaking it down into their core principles. I think that is the key to really truly understanding anything in life. Doesn't matter whether you're a resident or whether you're a psychologist or, you know, clinical researcher. If you can truly understand, you know, things from a first principle perspective, it makes it so much easier to think about, okay, you know, I truly understand the fundamentals of this topic or of this procedure. How can I think of a better way to achieve my end goal? And I think that's where, when you combine that with curiosity and the inventiveness that you get from playfulness, I think you can start coming up with ideas that really, you know, change the game.
So the actions I think that I'm going to distill from you is continue to ask lots of questions in your day. Go back to when it was like you'd be in a playground, if that, you know, for those of you who remember being in a playground and just having fun, right? And just like that childlike sense of wonder with the questions you ask. And then don't give up on them, right? What you're saying is keep trying to distill them down to what are the elements of the things that could lead to something interesting. And if you do that as a daily habit, it's going to help us move our own creative potential forward. Is that kind of what I'm hearing from you?
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, listen, on that note, Alex, thank you very much for sharing. We're going to definitely want to get you back in a year or so and when you've got some additional data to share with us. And hopefully you can tell us how we can become even more creative than we are. Mark, as usual, thanks so much. And I want you to rapidly heal up and get back to doing the things you love to do. But it's always good to have you on this podcast with us.
Very much a pleasure to meet you, Alex. And you're doing really important work. And keep at it, man.
Appreciate that. Thanks, gentlemen.
All right. Take care.